This is the home of the Broadcast Center News Team, KTVF, Channel 11, Fairfax.
This is where it begins. At the news director's desk, it begins with a call, a tip, a wire story, a hunch, and assignments are made, film crews dispatched, the probing commences. All the pieces must fit together by 6 o'clock for the Fairbanks Evening News. Saks, Hoyt's Jewelry, Fairbanks Office Supply, Golden North Appliance Center, and Aurora Motors make the time possible. And the hands of the Broadcast Center News Team members make clear, concise, professional news reporting a reality. Now from the Broadcast Center studios of KTVF Channel 11, the Fairbanks Evening News, your reporter, Larry Holmstrom.
Good evening. Headlining tonight's news, Interior Secretary Rogers Morton is raising knotty questions about the pipeline bill. Larry Carpenter has an interview with Dr. Arlen Tussing about the Fairbanks economy. Police say someone has tried to bomb the home of Fairbanks Black leader J.P. Jones. And Phil Deischer has a report on last night's school board meeting, that included testimony on the situation at Lathrop High School. First of all, the U.S. Senate version of a bill authorizing the Trans-Alaska Pipeline includes an amendment advancing payments of $15 million a year to Alaska Natives. The payments would be made to offset depreciating values of the dollar during delay of the pipeline construction. Now, Interior Secretary Rogers Morton says that provision should be removed. Morton said in a letter to Senator Henry Jackson that advanced payments to Natives could cause a backlash of sentiment against the pipeline. At the same time, it appeared the federal government does not want to make the advance payments. If pipeline construction is delayed beyond 1976, the bill provides that the payments would not be reimbursed to the federal treasury. Instead, the state of Alaska would be required to pay the federal treasury for the advance payments. Morton noted that the Native Land Claim Settlement Act made no provision for such payments. Broadcast Center News attempted to contact John Sackett of Doyon Limited for reaction to Morton's comments, but Sackett is not available until tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Associated Press attempted to reach Willie Hensley of the Alaska Federation of Natives, but Hensley apparently is in Washington and also not available until tomorrow. The question of advance pay to Natives wasn't the only one raised by Interior Secretary Morton in his letter to Senator Jackson. Morton also stated that he believes some of the language in the pipeline bill may be unconstitutional. Particularly, Morton pointed to a section declaring that Interior's environmental policy statement, impact statement rather, has met all federal laws. Alaska's two senators, Mike Gravel and Ted Stevens, were sponsors of the amendment, and today they said they believe Morton has overreacted to the language of the amendment. Both believe the amendment can stand legally. However, Stevens says it may be necessary to remove some wording and place it in a report rather than a bill. As for Senator Gravel, he had these comments.
The letter stresses that there is complete agreement with the goals and purposes of the bill. The Nixon administration is strongly committed to a bill that will give a final go-ahead to construction without additional court delay. The attorneys at the Interior Department disagree, however, on the best language to accomplish our common purpose. Lawyers often disagree on matters like this. In fact, I would be surprised if anybody felt different. This disagreement is good because it helps us be sure that the end product is the best possible one. I find it unfortunate that the letter discusses these different opinions in such strong, dramatic language, however.
We'll have more about that controversial provision of the pipeline bill in a few minutes in an interview with economist Arlen Tussing. The owner of Metamore Dairies in Fairbanks said today an estimated 10% increase in dairy products in the Fairbanks area can be expected in the next few days. Art Sexauer said he is expecting a call from his supplier tomorrow concerning a proposed price increase. Sexauer distributes Carnation dairy products in the Fairbanks area. He said the proposed increase should not come as a surprise with the cost of other food items on the rise. He said the increase, which will include two approved price hikes, will still keep milk as the best buy per pound of protein in the country. Sexauer said Carnation was given approval for a rate hike earlier this summer, but has held off putting it in effect for as long as possible. He said the 10% increase figure is only a rough estimate. Meanwhile, Sexauer said Arden dairy product distributors in Anchorage hiked their prices last month. Now with the weather, Fairbanks and Alaska, here's Ted Lamb.
Thank you, Larry. Well, it was light rain today. It invaded the southern Cook Inlet and spread gradually northward into the Susitna Valley. Everybody in Anchorage expected a nice day today, but they were surprised. The forecast yesterday was for good weather today, but there was light rain and drizzle throughout the day in that part of the state. Meanwhile, the weather along the North Gulf Coast and Copper River Basin has remained generally fair, about the only places in the state where it has. The clear skies, by the way, allowed temperatures to fall into the low 20s in the Copper River Basin this morning. Golconda reported the low for the state with 22 degrees. Skies were also mostly fair over the panhandle, but a weak storm off the Canadian coast did spread some cloudiness over the southern panhandle. Another weak storm off the northwestern coast continued to dampen the northwestern mainland with occasional light rain. Cloud layers associated with the storm have also spread into the northeastern interior regions. Skies are expected to clear over the southwestern mainland tomorrow as high pressure builds into the area. The northwestern interior, however, is expected to remain mostly cloudy with showers through Thursday. Our map shows Seattle had a terrible day today, at least compared to some of the weather they've been having in the last couple of weeks. It rained, it was 61. At Ketchikan, the sun shone brightly and the temperature was 62. As we had another nice day over the panhandle with Sitka partly cloudy and 60, and Juneau sun shining brightly, 55 degrees. Anchorage cloudy, some drizzle earlier today, 50 degrees. Down at Kodiak, fair skies, 54. At Beppo, clouds, 49. Nome, clouds, 44. They had some light drizzles. And Kotzebue, cloudy skies, 44 degrees. Barrow and rain, I should say, at Kotzebue. Light rain at Barrow fell about an hour and a half ago, and the temperature there is 37. Prudhoe Bay has cloudy skies, 39 degrees. We had clouds throughout the interior, with the temperature ranging from 50 at Fairbanks to 49 at Eielson and down to 44 degrees at Delta. Our high today in town was 51 degrees, barometer 2991 and steady. No rain today in Fairbanks, winds from the west at 8. The sunrise tomorrow 6:28, sunset 7 o'clock, 12 hours 32 minutes of sunlight tomorrow, 7 minutes less than today. The record high of 68 degrees was set in 1969 and the all-time low, a chilly 12 degrees in 1939. The forecast calls for mostly cloudy tonight with a 30% chance of occasional light rain. Partly cloudy Thursday through Thursday night. The low tonight and Thursday night in the mid-30s. The high Thursday should be near 60 degrees, and the outlook for Friday is for partly cloudy weather. Things may clear up just a bit for the Equinox Marathon this weekend. That's the weather information. The Fairbanks Evening News continues in a moment.
Don't waste your valuable time searching through stacks of papers for the one you need. Organize. Organization is the key to success, and at Fairbanks Office Supply, they have all the supplies you'll need. They have hanging files, frames and folders so you can convert a deep desk drawer into a handy file, and alphabetical file guides plus packet folders for bulky items. They have new fluorescent and pastel file folders from Denison. These are self-sticking and smudge-proof for easy reference. And, of course, Fairbanks Office Supply has many file folders in stock. They have index guides for binders and folders that you can make yourself to fit your need. And they even carry directory board letters. These handy letters come in three sizes, so you can tell people who you are, where you're located, and what you do. Stop in today at Fairbanks Office Supply, 3550 Airport Road or 552 3rd Avenue. They've got what it takes to get you organized.
From Aurora Motors at 1st and Lacey, your franchised Cadillac, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, and GMC dealer, this announcement. The 1974s are now available. Stop on down and take a look. And while you're there, ask any one of the fine salesmen about the discounted prices, the tremendous savings available on the 1973 cars still in stock. For example, here to tell us a little bit about a 1973 Cadillac, Harold Griffin. Griff, what have we got here?
A 1973 Sedan DeVille. With air conditioning, electric windows, 60-40 electric seats, electric rear window defogger, vinyl top.
We've even got the tinted windows all the way around.
Windows all the way around with a rear mirror with a temperature gauge on it. A very nice car.
We've got a beautiful top-of-the-line Cadillac here. Tremendous savings for you. Remember, these and more available at Aurora Motors. 1st and Lacey, your franchise, Cadillac, Oldsmobile, and Pontiac dealer. Stop by and see them soon.
Dr. Arlen Tusing is one of the nation's leading economists. For the past year and a half, he's been in Washington, D.C. as chief economist for the U.S. Senate's National Fuels and Energy Policy Study. Tusing returned to the university in Fairbanks this fall, where he is a professor of economics with the university's Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research. This week, Tusing has been lecturing for the Basic Industrial Development course, conducted jointly by the university and the State Division of Economic Enterprise. Our news director, Larry Carpenter, sat in on one of Tusing's lectures and then invited him to our studio for this wide-ranging interview on pipeline matters. It was a longer interview than most, but we will air it in its entirety because of the somewhat surprising remarks Tusing makes about the Fairbanks economy. It should also be noted that although Tusing's credentials are impeccable, there are other economists who disagree with him, and the Fairbanks business community has voiced its dislike for some of Tusing's comments in the past. In particular, the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce has been at odds with Tusing. Here's the interview.
If the pipeline is okayed, what kind of impact would Fairbanks experience?
Well, some of the impact Fairbanks has already experienced in the bidding up of land prices and in the residential and commercial construction that's been going on in the last year. The only new impact will probably be the sociological one, that is the great number of transient workers who will be coming into town, causing problems of public safety, and the large numbers of unemployed who will be attracted by the possibility of pipeline jobs.
Is it appropriate now for local government to prepare to meet the boomer, the transient?
I think so.
Anything else local government should be preparing right now?
Well, I think that preparing for the future beyond the pipeline construction is the best way to prepare for the pipeline period. That we ought to be paving our streets and sidewalks and improving the utilities here and providing some sort of realistic answer to the downtown air pollution problem that's polarizing people. But whether the pollution is going to block the future growth of Fairbanks through the medium of EPA restrictions or simply because people don't want to locate here when they hear about carbon monoxide and lead, it's a real problem. The way to take advantage of the pipeline boom is to start planning and to plan what kind of community we want 5, 10, 15 years from now.
Dr. Tusing, local businessmen want to know when they can expect an upturn in the economy because of the pipeline.
Well, as I said, I think it's already happened. Employment and gross receipts here are way ahead of what they were in 1969, and you can't explain it by the growth of the military, which has declined. The university activities have pretty much leveled off this year. And the growth that's taken place isn't directly related to pipeline construction. Investors believe that the Fairbanks area has a future. The pipeline is going to be built, that minerals and timber will be opened up in the area, that the population will grow, and so they're investing in both commercial and residential construction ahead of demand, and this process can continue for a number of years as long as there's a long-term prospect of growth.
The barbers are still saying that we're in a recession here in Fairbanks right now. We're out of it?
Well, I don't know what the situation of barbershops are. I understand long hair is going out, and maybe that would improve the situation.
But you believe our economy has decidedly turned up now?
Well, there's been a gradual growth. There's been little ups and downs, but there is more employment and more business here than there was 4 years ago, 2 years ago, and an upturn. A real boom will mean more unemployment, so the signs you get may be misleading. There'll be a lot more unemployment when the pipeline is under construction than there is now, because it will attract more job seekers than there will be pipeline jobs.
Some people are saying that 6 months after construction and the pipeline begins, people in Fairbanks will for the most part hate the pipeline. Will they?
I don't know.
Will it pose problems that would cause the public to dislike it? We wait in such great anticipation for it now.
Well, that depends in part on the strategy of Alyeska in building the thing and where the spreads are located and what kind of workers Alyeska brings in. And I'm not really up to date on the strategy. They were considering two possible strategies. One, maximizing the local hire and maximizing the number of people with families. And then the other would be isolated, bringing men only and putting them in isolated camps and flying them back to the lower 48 for R&R. And if the bulk of the workforce is isolated in remote camps and comes into Fairbanks only to get the airplane out, the sociological problems, the crime and the housing shortage and things like that will be relatively minimal. And it's hard to predict right now just what that impact is going to be.
Dr. Tusing, why is Anchorage seemingly making out so much bigger on the pipeline economically than Fairbanks?
Well, Anchorage has got it made already. It's the commercial and financial center of the state, and it's there to stay. And investors have no doubt that pipeline or not, Anchorage is going to grow. Now, that there is going to be further oil development and further development in the state, and Anchorage is going to get the bulk of the commercial activity, the consulting firms, the transportation, the financial services that are associated with that. It's interesting that in the Anchorage area, that military payrolls and oil industry employment have both declined very substantially since 1969, and nothing in the economic base has grown. Yet Anchorage is still in the midst of an economic boom. The construction that's going on there is fantastic. And that construction represents the faith of both Alaska and outside businessmen that Anchorage has got a long-term growth perspective. And it's pretty much independent of the year-to-year ups and downs in things like oil exploration or pipeline construction or whether the fishing season is good or not. Now, Fairbanks is a smaller place. It doesn't have as deep an economy, and it's more sensitive to these changes in expectations. But I think the Fairbanks experiences the same thing. The university has peaked out in terms of number of students, and probably the big university construction from now on will be in Anchorage. The military is going down. There's no exploration to speak of going on in the North Slope yet. Yet you can't say that the Fairbanks economy is worse off than it was in 1968 or 69. There are more jobs, and there's more sales and local businesses than there were then, because people believe that the town is here to stay.
You're going to be going back to Washington shortly as a consultant, again, to the Senate Interior Committee. Do you have a handle on what kind of time schedule? We've heard from the senators and our congressmen of what might happen, but what do you think is going to happen?
You mean on the pipeline
on
itself?
The pipeline bill, yeah.
Well, the bill will be reported out sometime in October and will be passed and will be signed by the president. Whether the bill means a pipeline permit this fall is another question, because there's several legal unknowns.
If you had to go one direction or the other, Dr. Tusing, would you say that this thing will get hung up in the courts again or not?
Oh, I'd say the chances are about 50-50 that there will be more legal delays.
That's less optimistic than some pro-pipeliners would like to think. They've heard otherwise.
Yeah, it's very hard to change the rules the way that the Gravel Amendment in the Senate or the House bill tried to do with respect to NEPA without throwing in some new issues that can be litigated.
Have you heard what Interior Secretary Rogers Morton said today?
No.
His attorneys have advised him to question the wording of the provision that takes this out of the courts. He said that it should be reworded. Senator Gravel is questioning whether it should be reworded. Did you have any misgivings about that provision of the bill?
Well, Senator Jackson, with whom I work, was opposed to that provision. He felt that that trying to exempt the pipeline from NEPA raised in itself legal questions that could cause more
litigation. Is this the reason you say 50-50, largely because of this provision?
Well, there's some other things. The state and the companies still haven't settled their disagreements. The governor will have to call a special session of the legislature to implement any deal made between the state and the and the state between the state administration and the companies, and bringing the legislature in, of course, introduces a new unknown. The pipeline is very vulnerable to antitrust action. That is, it's one of the most vulnerable pipelines in the country with respect to accusations of monopoly. Here you have three companies own 92% of the North Slope reserves, 82% of the pipeline.
Are you saying that after a pipeline permit issues that Alyeska could be slapped with an antitrust suit and an injunction that would stop construction?
Well, there are all sorts of possibilities. For example, a private antitrust suit is in the offing against a couple of the pipelines in the lower 48 that are organized along the same lines as Alyeska. These are private triple damage suits. Now, even if there were no injunction or no suit against Alyeska, the underwriters for the Alyeska credit may look twice at releasing the money to build the thing when a similar pipeline is subject to lawsuits for several billion dollars in damages for having injured oil independence or something like that. I'm not saying that any one of these things is probable, but there are so many unknowns
I'm going to turn my question around. My final question here, Dr. Tusing, would you also give it 50-50, therefore, of a actual construction startup in the spring on the pipeline? Would that be 50-50?
I think that's a reasonable other side of the coin.
That was economist Arlen Tusing, who plans to fly to Washington, D.C. this weekend to work on the Senate House Conference Committee report on the pipeline bill. The New York stock market closed sharply higher today in one of its strongest days of the year. Trading was very heavy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up more than 19 points. More than 24.5 million shares were traded. Brokers credit much of the advance to rallying glamour issues, some of which had taken a beating in trading earlier this week. IBM was up substantially. Its opening was delayed for the third straight session since a federal court ruling against the company in an antitrust suit with Telex. IBM had lost nearly 38 points in the last two sessions. The Fairbanks Evening News will continue in a moment.
A trip to Hoyt's Jewelry is like walking through a watchmaker's Hall of Fame. You'll be surrounded by famous name watches, such as these men's watches by Bulova, Longines, Wetnar, including the famous Accutron. Now, these watches are more than timepieces. They're works of art, covered with beautiful gold nuggets by Bill Hoyt himself. Hoyt's hasn't forgotten the ladies either. You'll find a complete selection of Bulova watches, Longines, Wetnar too, all exquisitely crafted with gold nuggets by Bill Hoyt. Women's watches or men's watches, they're artistic masterpieces when they're from Hoyt's Jewelry. Use your MasterCharge Bank AmeriCard or Hoyt's convenient Christmas layaway plan. Make your Christmas selections early at Hoyt's Jewelry, downtown at 543 2nd Avenue.
There's no meal quite like a Sunday meal. No one's in a rush, and the entire family can take time to enjoy one another's company. And a Sunday meal can be an especially big treat for Mom if she doesn't have to prepare it. Enter the Fairbanks Inn with an idea so good, at a price so reasonable, lots of Fairbanks families will probably begin to make it an every Sunday habit. The Fairbanks Inn now offers a Sunday buffet from 1 to 5 p.m. for just $3.95 for adults. Children 5 to 12 are half price, and children under 5 eat for free. And the food? Well, there's enough variety to satisfy any taste, and it's all professionally prepared by the chef gastronomique extraordinaire. The surroundings are relaxing, and the service is first cabin. So why not start a new family tradition in your family this Sunday? Try the buffet family special from 1 to 5 p.m. this Sunday and every Sunday at the Fairbanks Inn. There's no meal quite like a Sunday meal.
Fairbanks state troopers report that two persons have died in separate motor vehicle accidents. A 79-year-old Canwell man died yesterday when the motorcycle he was driving was struck by a car near the intersection of the Anchorage-Fairbanks Highway and the Denali Highway.
Troopers say Henry John Pallage was crossing the highway on a Honda when he was struck by a car driven by Gordon Garand of Fort Wainwright. According to troopers, Garand attempted to evade Pallage but could not. Pallage died shortly after the collision. And troopers report that a two-car accident 17 miles north of Nenana took the life of 63-year-old Nelson Joseph of Fairbanks early this morning. According to troopers, he was a passenger in a pickup truck driven by his brother, 45-year-old William Joseph, also of Fairbanks. Troopers say Joseph's pickup collided head-on with a car driven by 21-year-old Russell Barnett of Fairbanks. Barnett is in satisfactory condition at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital with a fracture and bruises. William Joseph is listed in poor condition with a back injury, and another passenger, James Jacinto of Fairbanks, also is listed in poor condition with fractures of the legs and chest injuries. No citations were issued by troopers. Fairbanks City Police have identified two persons found dead in a Fairbanks apartment last night. Police say 44-year-old Robert Sweeper and 22-year-old Christine Thomason were found shot to death at 555 11th Avenue at almost midnight last night. An investigation has reportedly revealed that Sweeper shot and killed Ms. Thomason and then took his own life with the same weapon. A coroner's inquest has been scheduled for September 28th. Fairbanks Police Chief Bob Sundberg announced late this afternoon that someone attempted to bomb the home of Black leader J.P. Jones early this morning. In a news release at 4:30 this afternoon, Sundberg said the police department was called to Jones' residence at 1710 South Cushman at 1 a.m. Sundberg said officers found a small bundle wrapped in a newspaper on the stairs. He said it contained six sticks of dynamite. Broadcast Center News learned that the fuse had been ignited but burned out before setting off the charge. Sundberg did not say whether there are any suspects in the case. Jones is president of the Fairbanks chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. According to another news release today from Fairbanks City Police, arrangements have been made to supplement local state troopers and Fairbanks police with trained personnel in the event of civil disturbance in the Fairbanks area. Yesterday, eight state troopers trained in riot control were flown into Fairbanks as a test of the arrangements to provide local assistance in a short period of time. Captain Ralph Schaefer of the Fairbanks State Troopers and Fairbanks Chief of Police Bob Sundberg stated they were pleased with the results of the call for assistance and indicated that similar requests will be made in the future if it's deemed necessary. A group of about 70 student leaders from Lathrop High School testified last night that there is virtually no racial unrest at the school. The testimony came during nearly 3 hours of public comment at last night's regular meeting of the Fairbanks North Star Borough School Board. Phil Deischer attended the meeting and filed this report.
The student leaders, both black and white, said they represented and spoke for the majority of students at Lathrop High School. They also said that a stabbing incident at Lathrop High School Saturday night was not the result of racial tension, but rather the act of someone from off the school campus, probably a young GI. In the stabbing, 16-year-old David Allen received a deep knife wound in the upper back. The youth was in Fairbanks Memorial Hospital for 3 days and went home yesterday. The feelings of the 70 students was expressed in a brief prepared statement which came out of a two-hour meeting of the students yesterday afternoon. The statement was read by student body president Leland Rich.
A large percentage of the students at Lathrop High School wish to point out that there is no racial conflict taking place at Lathrop High School. The facts are as follows. Saturday night, September 15th, a white youth was stabbed on the Lathrop High School campus. He was allegedly stabbed by one black youth who has not yet been identified. The motive is unknown, and for this reason there is no basis for what has been labeled, quote, as racial conflicts. The publicity given to this incident has caused the entire situation to be blown out of proportion. The problem did not involve the entire student body and was an isolated incident of individual nature. Racial connotations implied by the press do not exist. This was the finding of a meeting of 75 concerned black and white students, as I have stated before, which Mr. Jones did attend, but he didn't seem to agree with.
With Rich at the school board meeting were several dozen black and white students from Lathrop High School. About a dozen of them went before the board to state that a racial problem at Lathrop High School is non-existent. The president of the Fairbanks chapter of the NAACP, J.P. Jones, spoke briefly last night, saying there is a racial problem any place where two different races have a difference of opinion. Jones also said the black community cannot keep riding the tide of white superiority. The younger blacks did not appear to support longtime Fairbanks black leader Jones. Following Rich's prepared statement, school board member Chuck Reese asked if the students knew the identity of the assailant in the Saturday night stabbing. A black student in the audience called out, "That's a police problem." Rich followed that up by saying the students do not feel that Allen's assailant was a student at Lathrop High. Rich also said problems at the school could be handled by students. One student reassured the board that there is not a general atmosphere of racism at the school. There are occasional problems, he said, yes, but not an overbearing atmosphere. About criticism of the media, one student, Patricia Allison, said a student interviewed by Broadcast Center News on Monday made inflammatory remarks, in her words, just to get on the news. Teachers and students who testified last night said there was not a racial problem at the school. On the other hand, the school came in for a share of licks from the mother of the stabbed youth, Mrs. Jean Salides. Mrs. Salides, sometimes choked with emotion, told this story of her family's experience at Lathrop.
Well, first I should say they're not honor students. They may not even have been good students, but they have been good sons, and they have not been troublemakers at this school. Their names are Scott Allen, Dana Allen, and David Allen. Scott did not finish high school here. He got discouraged and quit. Fortunately, when he was in the Army, he got his GED. He's fine. He's got a little business going for himself here now, and he's doing well. Dana didn't finish either because he got discouraged here at Lathrop. I'm not going to give David the chance to get discouraged, because he might be dead first. That's just exactly the way I feel about it.
Mrs. Salides said she doesn't know what is wrong with Lathrop High School, and in her words, something is just amiss at the school. Mrs. Salides, wife of State Senator George Salides, said the school lacked school spirit. Senior class president Mary Johnson said this has been the best year ever for school spirit at Lathrop High. Yesterday, absenteeism at the school was at almost one quarter of the student body. Student leaders called for all students to return to school in an effort to build the confidence of the student body and prove to the administration that the students themselves can conquer whatever difficulties may or may not exist. Last night, students indicated a willingness to continue meetings in an effort to get a firm handle on whatever social problems may come up at the school. Phil Deischer, Broadcast Center News.
At last word, student leaders at Lathrop High School are holding an assembly at the school at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The purpose of the meeting is not exactly clear. However, Fairbanks media have been invited to the assembly. That's the news for tonight. I'm Larry Holmstrom, Broadcast Center News. Good night.
Man has long pursued the ice cube. Now the ice cube comes to man through General Electric's custom dispenser refrigerator, the easiest way ever to get ice cubes. The only way to get crushed ice and chilled water automatically, all in GE's largest side-by-side refrigerator freezer. Come out of that old ice age.
Sometimes we try to stuff too much in too little space. A good trick if you can do it. And you can with General Electric's Big Top refrigerator. Only 30 and a half inches wide, almost 21 cubic feet, with over 45% more freezer capacity than any GE top freezer model ever made. And under the Big Top, adjustable shelves and porta bins. New from General Electric.
You'll find these and other fine appliances at Golden North, the Appliance Center at 845 College Road.
Attention, large men, small men, tall men, short men, all sizes. Sax Men's Shop, in conjunction with Michael Stearns, will have Mr. Kirk Callahan, a master tailor, at the Traveler's Inn for 3 days, starting Friday the 21st of September, 2 to 9 p.m., September 22nd, noon to 7, and September 23rd, 11 to 5. Now, whether you're a size 35 short or a size 60 long, you will have the opportunity to see over 50 suits and sports coats that can be made up for you. And if you do not wish a custom fit, you can order stock sizes. This showing has been brought to town especially for you men who have trouble getting a suit to fit. Remember, from size 35 short to 60 long, plus athletics, stout, extra long, and regulars, stop by Suite 230, Travelers Inn. Have a cup of coffee. Take a look at this special showing for your hard-to-fit men. Saks Men's Shop, with Kirk Callahan of Michael Stern, will be there to serve you and discuss any problems you may have in getting a good-fitting suit or sports coat. This is American-made clothing.
The local segment of the Fairbanks Evening News has been brought to you by Aurora Motors, Golden North Appliance Center, Fairbanks Office Supply, Hoyt's Jewelry, and Saks. Engineering by Steve Fletcher. Cameramen Mike McFadden and Bob Hartman. Color photography by Gary Russell. Technical director, Vern Frohl. Executive producer, Larry Carpenter. The news continues with an in-depth look at the nation and the world on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
From CBS News headquarters in New York, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. And in Washington, Eric Severi, Dan Rather, Daniel Shore, Leslie Stahl, Roger Mudd, Bruce Morton, Bob Schieffer, and Charles Carrault on the road tonight in Kenwood, California.
Good evening. Rumors have been circulating for weeks that Vice President Agnew will resign because of the investigation involving him in Maryland. Today, the Washington Post said it had learned that Agnew has been discussing this possibility and quoted an unnamed senior Republican figure as being all but certain that Agnew will quit, possibly this week. More from Dan Rather.
The Vice President, with other guests, shook hands all around at a luncheon today honoring Pakistan's Prime Minister Ali Bhutto. When it was over, Mr. Agnew spoke briefly with reporters.
Mr. Vice President, are you considering resigning as reported?
Well, you know, it's my practice not to comment on stories from undisclosed sources that I have here.
It is true the Vice President has talked about resigning. It is true that he left the impression with at least one of the persons who talked with him about it that he might even step down as early as this week. CBS News has confirmed this through its own sources. Mr. Agnew is said to have talked about resigning mostly because of stress on his family, partly because he has become convinced that the president won't help him. Everyone who claims to know anything about this emphasizes that while the vice president has been considering and discussing possible resignation, that so far as they know, he has not gone beyond that. No one claims to have heard him say that he thought he would resign. President Nixon, through his official spokesman, today sent out a new signal that is widely interpreted as indicating that the president perhaps wouldn't mind if Mr. Agnew quit. Spokesman Gerald Warren, after consulting with Mr. Nixon, would not deny that the vice president is considering resigning. He wouldn't deny either that the president perhaps wants Mr. Agnew to step out. Under repeated questioning, with the warnings about what the impressions might be, all Warren would say was no comment. Under the circumstances, this White House refusal to speak out for Mr. Agnew is widely interpreted by political pros as being part of a deliberate presidential strategy to increase the pressure on Vice President Agnew. As the Agnew camp was saying by day's end, what the White House is doing certainly doesn't help. Dan Rather, CBS News, the White House.
The Senate Watergate Committee, at a closed meeting today, decided to move quickly into the next phase of its investigation when hearings resume Monday. Daniel Shore has the details.
In today's executive session, the remaining Watergate phase all but vanished. Dropped from the witness list, three defense lawyers and two of the White House plumbers, E. Joe Krogh and David Young, allegedly involved in the break-in on Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. Former White House Special Counsel Charles Colson, also facing possible indictment in the burglary, will be interviewed in executive session tomorrow before it's decided whether he'll be called. What starts next Monday is what Chairman Ervin now calls the transition into Phase 2, Dirty Tricks. Howard Hunt, who is asking to change his guilty plea in the Watergate bugging to innocent, will lead off. And some additional witnesses were announced today who will appear in this order. John Caulfield, former New York policeman, Treasury aide, and White House undercover investigator, who has already testified on his role in trying to get James McCord to keep silent.
His associate John Reagan, former FBI agent, later Republican security chief, reportedly involved in wiretapping. Patrick Buchanan, presidential speechwriter, writer of President Nixon's news summaries, who also wrote memos on campaign strategy. More crucial in the witness list, the Battle of the Tapes. The Senate committee today filed a memorandum with federal district court saying that if the committee has a stronger right to the presidential tapes than Special Prosecutor Cox because its request, quote, focuses on the president's own possible criminality, unquote. The memorandum also says, quote, if the accuracy of John Dean's account is substantiated in all particulars, the continuance of the presidency may be in jeopardy and he may be subjected to criminal penalties, unquote. And without the tapes, the Senate committee argues, its hearings may have to be prolonged, and it will be necessary to question others who may have heard the tapes. Daniel Shaw, CBS News, Washington.
President Nixon's secret tape recordings of White House conversations have become the target of a new court action, this one seeking the tapes of a meeting with dairymen 2 days before an increase in milk price supports. Leslie Stahl reports.
Presidential Counsel J. Fred Bizarre has revealed that a tape recording was made of a March 23, 1971 meeting between the president and 14 representatives of large dairy farm cooperatives. In an affidavit filed in district court, Bizarre says the president, claiming executive privilege, will not disclose the tape. The recording and other White House documents are being sought by consumer groups led by Ralph Nader. They've charged that the government's 1971 increase in milk price supports was a payoff for contributions to the Nixon campaign. This much of the case is known from sworn depositions and documents made public. That on March 12, 1971, then-Agriculture Secretary Clifford Hardin refused to increase milk price supports. On March 22nd, one of the largest dairy co-ops donated $10,000 to the Nixon campaign. On March 23rd, 14 dairymen met with the president in the cabinet room. On March 24, another large co-op donated $25,000 to the Nixon campaign. And on March 25th, Secretary Hardin announced an increase in milk price supports. Nader's lawyer, William Dobrevere, today filed a court motion to compel the production of the tape and two White House documents. One, the still-secret list of large campaign contributors, which apparently includes the dairymen. Asked to comment, Dobrevere said, the White House asserts executive privilege with anything that looks like it might have evidentiary value. Leslie Stahl, CBS News, Washington.
A front-wheel drive Subaru gets around 25 miles on a gallon of regular, and some owners report getting better than 30, while the average car gets around 13.5 miles to the gallon. So if you're driving an average car, a Subaru with its unique quadrizotal engine could cut your gas bill almost in half. One big reason why every day more and more people trade for a Subaru. 9 Lives presents Morris.
Picnics are for ants.
Morris, let's play.
I'm not feeling athletic.
Morris, Dindin!
Now I'll play my finicky game.
It's 9 Lives, dear.
9 Lives?
Mackerel, tuna, and chicken.
Uh-oh, 9 Lives, tuna, and chicken.
9 Lives, nutritious foods cats really like, even Morris.
9 Lives, this finicky game is rough.
Spurred by the Watergate scandal, the Senate Rules Subcommittee has begun 4 days of hearings on election campaign financing, and there was bipartisan backing for the idea of public payment of some or all of the costs. Roger Mudd reports.
The idea of the taxpayer financing political campaigns got the approval today from a long line of witnesses, but most of them acknowledged that workable legislation would be difficult to write. Senators Kennedy and Scott joined to propose mandatory public financing of all federal elections through an income tax return checkoff.
My own view is that the current system of private financing of political campaigns is so infected with actual and potential corruption that only intensive surgery can cure the patient. To me, the best way to heal the system is to eliminate private financing altogether and establish a new program of comprehensive public financing for all federal elections. At a single stroke, by enacting a system of public financing, Congress can shut off the underground rivers of private campaign contributions and special influence money that poison politics at every level of federal government. If Watergate has taught us anything, it is that the reporting and disclosure requirements we enacted in 1972 are not enough.
Scott said he had hoped that public disclosure and spending limits would eliminate the corrosive power of money, but Scott said he was wrong.
With these limits comes a morass of enforcement problems, not to mention the problem of fairness to less well-endowed challengers. The next logical step, which Senator Kennedy and I are now proposing, is full public financing. It is our last best hope to restore full confidence in public officials and government.
Despite Senator Scott's support, public financing of political campaigns is not an issue that burns brightly in the GOP. The witness list here carries few Republican names. Party Chairman George Bush is sending a deputy to testify. Even Attorney General Elliot Richardson, the administration's Mr. Clean, is sending a deputy to testify. The GOP, whose success with private money has been mind-blowing, just can't bring himself to help bail out the Democrats with tax money. Roger Mudd, CBS News, Capitol Hill. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has approved the nomination of Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State. George McGovern cast the only opposing vote, and he himself characterized it as symbolic, a protest against what McGovern called the needless prolongation of the Vietnam War. Confirmation by the full Senate is expected later this week.
Georgie, you are about to see the investment idea of the century.
Al,
the electric fork.
Oh, Al.
I can get you in on the ground
floor. Al, I've got my money invested in something else.
More and more people are discovering savings accounts at Savings and Loans. The return is substantial, and your money is insured up to $20,000 by an agency of the federal government.
Al, is this the same guy who invented the folding waterbed?
That's not funny, Georgie. I almost drowned.
Your savings and loan wants you to know how money works.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thanks.
Say, did you notice Margaret yesterday?
Yes, she seemed quiet.
Mm-hmm. Definitely not the old Margaret.
Hi, girl.
Margaret.
Say, who wants to go to the dress sale? I hear they have some fantastic buys.
Margaret's problem? Occasional irregularity. But look, she's back in the swing with Haley's M.O. Good tasting Haley's is a gentle, gentle blend that works. When you need a laxative, get back in the swing with Haley's M.O.
A racketeer who specialized in security thefts and swindles testified at a Senate hearing today that he was offered a contract to kill the governor of the Bahamas. Bruce Morton reports.
Convicted stock swindler Louis Mastriana told a lot of stories of beating banks, cashing one legitimate check at Phoebe Rebozo's Key Biscayne Bank. But the strangest tale was this. He said Elliot Roosevelt, one-time mayor of Miami Beach, teamed up with alleged gangster Mike McClaney to pay $1 million for a gambling franchise to Lyndon Pindling, Prime Minister of the Bahamas. When they didn't get it, Mastriana said, Roosevelt and friend tried to hire him to kill Pindling.
He came to me and offered me $100,000 to whack him, to kill him. They gave me $10,000 front money, $7,500 in cash and a check for $2,500.
And they expected you to do what for that?
To kill him.
Mastriana also talked about cunning banks with, among other tricks, phony checks from the Bank of Sark, an island in the English Channel.
Well, at the time when I was moving Sark paper, there was a red flag on it throughout the country.
You mean there was a state of alert as far as the Bank of Sark? Yeah. And all banks had been advised or have available to them at least that kind of information. How long had there been a state of alert about the
Bank of Sark? Oh, I'd say approximately 2 or 3 months.
2 or 3 months?
Yes, sir.
Well, how many Bank of Sark's checks were you able to pass before you got caught up?
Well, actually, I never got caught passing a Bank of Sark check.
Well, how many of them did you pass?
Okay.
Roughly. In terms of dollars, if you can remember.
That was a considerable amount. It runs into the millions, sir.
It ran into the millions?
Yes, sir.
And in various places throughout the country?
Yes, sir. Well, Vegas is a tough place to beat. We beat them for about $40,000.
In Vegas? Did you do as well at the crap table?
No, I blew it all on the table. Fast women. Between the broads and the tables, I went broke.
Mastriana is now serving an 8-year prison term. Bruce Morton, CBS News, Washington.
Reached by CBS News in Portugal, Elliot Roosevelt said that the testimony was a complete and utter fabrication and outright lie. He said he never had anything to do with anything in the Bahamas. At the UN Security Council today, the United States said Cuba has no business protesting that its embassy in Chile had been attacked during last week's coup. Ambassador John Scali said the U.S. Embassy also came under fire, and other U.S. embassies in other countries have similarly been attacked in the past. But, said Scali, such cases do not constitute a threat to international peace and security. In Santiago, meanwhile, the new military regime still was trying to wipe out scattered resistance. Chile's 163rd Independence Day was observed, but hardly celebrated. A huge parade was canceled because, as one source said, the people have seen enough of tanks and guns. The Cambodian army today reported success on two fronts. Southwest of Phnom Penh, the government said it had reopened Highway 4, the key overland supply route that's been cut for almost a month. And to the north of Phnom Penh, other Cambodian forces claim to have cleared the provincial capital of Kampong Cham of the last communist infiltrators. There was evidence today of new moves toward Arab unity. Jordan's King Hussein, who 10 days ago met with other Arab leaders, declared a general amnesty for about 300 Palestinian guerrillas and political prisoners. That included a number of persons who have tried to get rid of Hussein, including guerrilla leader Abu Daoud. Twice this year, terrorists have seized Saudi Arabian embassies, one in Khartoum and the other in Paris, demanding his release.
So you finally got little Janie married.
Never thought I'd see the day.
Even when you can't hold up any longer, your hair can with Finalnet. It's not an aerosol hairspray. It's Clairol's clear mist you spritz on once to hold three times longer than the best-selling hairspray. Finalnet holds up longer than you do.
You look divine, considering.
There's not much difference in pain relievers that you can see. But in your bloodstream, the differences are very real. While all three leading pain relievers reach an effective level in minutes, in the final analysis, only one of them hits and holds the highest level, Anacin. This difference is the extra pain reliever Anacin provides when you have a headache. Remember, the difference in Anacin is the higher level of pain reliever. Anacin relieves pain fast.
The Civil Service Commission today ordered the Air Force to give back, with back pay, to Ernest Fitzgerald his Pentagon job, the one that he lost after having exposed the huge cost overrun of the C-5A transport. Bob Schieffer reports.
The C-5A had all kinds of problems, including wheels that fell off on at least one occasion. Fitzgerald got into trouble with the Air Force when he told a congressional committee about another problem with the plane in 1968. He said then that the program might suffer more than $2 billion in cost overruns. The prediction was correct, but shortly after he made it, the Air Force fired him. Today, the Civil Service Commission finally ruled that the Air Force acted improperly, a move that delighted Senator William Proxmire.
I think the message should now go out to all those who work for the government that you can speak up, that you can tell the truth about waste in government, and that you won't be punished necessarily, that you can be rewarded.
I was just pleased that they ruled in our favor, ruled the firing was improper, and that I should go back to work.
Well, do you plan to go back to the Pentagon?
Oh, of course. I have unfinished business in the Pentagon.
Would you be willing to do it all over again to tell about the cost overruns on military projects?
Well, it's hard. Let me say I don't regret it. Whether it's worth it or not, something else, but I don't regret it.
Fitzgerald also said he's anxious to get started, but the Air Force didn't comment. Bob Schieffer, CBS News, Washington.
It seems there's a bad drinking problem in the Army. Brigadier General Leslie Forney, head of the Army's Alcohol and Drug Policy Division, testified today on Capitol Hill that 36% of the officers and 70% of the enlisted men are considered heavy or problem drinkers. The most significant problem, he said, is with young enlisted men, about 5,000 of whom are enrolled in the Army's rehabilitation program. As far as public opinion goes, there's been some indication of success in President Nixon's strategy to put Watergate behind him and move on. But Eric Severide thinks it may be too late for that strategy. Here's his analysis.
The last few weeks seem likely to go down as the phony war period in the struggle over Watergate and associated scandals. Those with sufficient gray in their hair will remember the first year of World War II, the many months when nothing much happened. A feeling developed in Europe and here that there was something phony about the war. People got bored with the communiques, they drifted back to normal business, began to think secret deals were patching things up, and that the showdown would somehow be avoided. But all the while, the armies grew, the munitions factories hummed, and the big guns were being wheeled into position. A clumsy analogy, but with a certain relevance. The mills of justice grind slowly, but once set in motion, they can only grind on. An automaton.